Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Welcome to the Path to Zero. I'm your host, Tucker Perkins, and I'm very glad to be with you for this episode. With the guest I invite onto the show, I'm taking a journey through the complex and often messy world that's the global world of energy. I'm searching for conversations that will help shed light on how we, our country, our world, our community, can move toward a low-carbon future. In this episode, I've got a very special guest, Professor Alice Kazwan from the University of San Francisco. I'm really excited to talk to her because in our conversation, we're going to focus on the issues of environmental justice, which is a subject that's of serious interest to me. Hi, Professor, and welcome to the Path to Zero.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Before we dive too deep today into a conversation, tell me a little bit about your background. You're actually an attorney, I know, but you've got a special interest in environmental justice and climate change policy. Tell me a little bit more about that background.
Well, I would say I do have a law degree and have even passed a couple of bar exams, but my calling is as a professor of law. So that's an ideal role for me because I get to think about the big picture, but I'm also close to the profession and its impact. I love being a professor of law because law is an area where you really send people out to make a difference in the world. But as a professor, I think I get to sit a little bit above the fray and think the big thoughts. And one of the thoughts I've enjoyed having the chance to think about is environmental justice. I'd say I've had a long-standing interest in both the environment and in social justice. So it's a very natural combination for me to be able to explore a field where I'm thinking about people and their well-being and about justice in our society, and in particular about their health and safety, which is, I think, the focus, or at least my focus when I look at environmental law and environmental justice.
As I was preparing and studying a little bit about your background, I love how you talk about, yes, you're an attorney, but attorneys are more than just those that litigate. They actually help solve problems. And I loved how you talked about that. And you've written extensively around carbon pricing and climate justice. You've talked about the EPA's clean power plan that you critiqued as being really too easy to attain the carbon reduction goals. And you talk often about a greener energy grid. Can you talk more for our listeners about the higher level connection between those topics and the law?
I think sometimes people think of the law in terms of lawsuits and courts and judges' rulings, but law is a lot more than that. A lot of key policy debates end up embodied in law. So you just identified a whole range of policy issues, things like carbon pricing or the role for social justice, or I think in the Clean Power Plan, a lot of issues around how we structure what the federal government requires and then what that means for the states, what's the role of renewable energy. And a lot of these issues are resolved by legislatures, whether they're state or federal. Sometimes these issues are resolved by agencies as they have to implement laws. And lawyers and law professors, I'd say, are very involved in these policy debates that ultimately get embodied in laws and regulations. When I teach environmental law, for example, sometimes the students are surprised that we're reading so few cases, but most of what lawyers do is read and apply regulations and read and understand statutes and follow the development of those regulations and those statutes and what agencies do. So, a lot of what lawyers do is think about the underlying policies and how they either will be or have been embodied in law.
So let's now talk about another relationship, and that's the relationship between environmentalism and environmental justice. Could you help with just setting out the definitions, perhaps, of environmentalism and environmental justice?
Sure, I can talk. If you want to spend another 3 hours, no. So I think we've got in environmentalism, an area that covers an awful lot of ground, and different people or different kinds of organizations will focus on different aspects, even different agencies, different laws will focus on different aspects of environmental law. So some of environmental law is quite focused on nature. So if you look at Wilderness Acts or Park Service or some of the things people commonly associate with environmentalism, they often think of nature and people being able to enjoy nature. Other parts of environmentalism are focused on nature for the benefit of other species. So if you think about the Endangered Species Act, and then there's a lot of environmental law that focuses more generally on public health and safety. So that's probably the more human-centered aspects or anthro-centered aspects of environmental law. So we're looking at pollution control, to some degree flood control. When we think about wetland protections, they're partly about dealing with risks of flooding, hazardous materials management, whether it's controlling how we produce and manage waste, or dealing with the legacy of environmental contamination. So environmentalism, again, covers a lot of ground. Environmental justice has a lot of different dimensions. I often like to think about and break apart the different forms of justice that are at stake. Some of the focus in environmental justice is about what we call distributive justice. It's looking at how are things distributed, right? How many hazardous waste landfills are located near communities of color as compared with non-communities of color? Or what's the distribution of risk, right? How much are the, do we have pollution and pollution risks concentrated in certain areas and not in others? Some of it is less focused on, some of the environmental justice focus is less on just what we would call distributive justice, how are things distributed, and more about what we might call procedural or participatory justice. And it's more about decision-making processes. Do people feel like decision-making processes are fair, right? Independent of how things are distributed, do we feel like people are being treated fairly as decisions are being made? And then lastly, and I think this is very important to understand, particularly as we think about the influence of the Black Lives Matter movement, and that's a broader social justice concern, right? And that is that any given decision, right? We might have a decision about where to put some PCBs or a decision about where to put a compressor station, right? Which occurred in the Atlantic Coast Pipeline situation recently. Any given decision rests in turn on layers of injustice. And we can think of that both in terms of time, right? We have historic patterns of segregation and discrimination that led to unequal distribution of the harms that we see out there. So it's partly a time dimension, the social justice aspect, looking historically as well as at the present. And then there's also a multiple issues dimension. So when you have a given issue, right, a compressor station or a new landfill, that harm or that concern is not experienced in isolation. It's a sense of an additional injustice being added onto cumulative impacts, not just from pollution, right? Not just focused on the environment, but the cumulative impacts of poverty, of less desirable living environments, housing challenges, of discrimination, again, all the way to policing practices, right? It's a sense that any given decision, again, is occurring on top of a legacy of disadvantage, and that makes the wound a little bit deeper.
You've recently referred to environmental justice as a movement. Do you really think that this concept has reached movement status?
I'd say it does have a self-conscious identity. I'd say it's been considered a movement more or less since the late 1980s. People of color or disadvantaged communities have been opposing projects they don't want in their communities, or opposing the sense that they feel as though they have been the dumping grounds for a lot of undesirable uses. They've been doing that, of course, since industrialization began, right? So for decades. But in the late 1980s, communities began to be recognized and get more national attention. There was a very well-publicized event in North Carolina with location of a PCB disposal site where we had a congressman arrested and people lying on the ground to block the trucks. And so that got a lot of national attention and in fact got the attention of some of the national civil rights organizations. And that's when people started to look at all of these different grassroots efforts going on around the country and see a connection that there was a pattern of disparate environmental experiences happening in communities of color in particular, as well as some low-income communities. And then in the last couple of decades, we've seen the emergence of state or national organizations that have functioned as umbrella groups for many of these different grassroots efforts. I wouldn't say that this movement has necessarily always succeeded, that they've always won every challenge that they have encountered. But I think they're nonetheless could be considered a movement because they have some clear goals, they have some clear principles, and they are working to affect policy over time.
You know, one of the markers I see in movements is that they pick up momentum when they link with other serious social issues. And certainly the last couple months have seen no shortage for us of serious social issues between Black Lives Matter and a worldwide pandemic around COVID-19. Al Gore came out in opposition to the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline, saying it represented environmental racism. That connection brought together two very difficult issues, right? Environmentalism and racism. What linkages has environmental justice made to other movements, in your opinion?
I'd say environmental justice has been always about linking racial justice and environmental conditions. In fact, the environmental justice movement has emerged from and grounded in the civil rights movement. It has long had varied efforts at linking with what we call the traditional environmental movement. It's been difficult at times because the environmental movement tends to be a little bit more narrowly focused on environmental concerns with less of a focus on the socioeconomic implications of environmental policies. And sometimes those in the environmental justice movement have been frustrated that when they've attempted to work with those in the environmental movement, not as much weight has been given to social justice as they would like to see. So it has created some tension, but it has been, I think, there have been a lot of efforts to work on connecting the traditional environmental movement and the environmental justice movement, and efforts that I think are accelerating with the profile of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about how environmental justice and a low-carbon future intersect.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
My guest today is Professor Alice Caswan from the University of San Francisco. She's a climate change and environmental justice expert, and we're so glad to have her. Just before the break, we were talking about how environmental justice has matured as a movement and started to play a role in shaping the development of large-scale energy projects. Professor, I was looking back at the press release put out by Duke Energy and Dominion Energy regarding the canceled ACP project. Both CEOs said, "This announcement reflects the increasing legal uncertainty that overhangs large-scale energy and industrial infrastructure development in the U.S." That statement, to me, seems like a signal that the days of big energy projects are coming to an end. They're just too hard to get permitted. And at the same time, we know that from government projections, energy demand in the U.S. is going to continue to grow. How do you reconcile those competing ideas?
Well, I think there is legal uncertainty, no question. For example, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the legal uncertainty there is the kind of permitting they're going to need to do for wetland crossings. And they've had, again, a multitude of issues over the years with their permits and approvals. I think legal uncertainty is an issue for them, but I would hazard that there are additional uncertainties that they're facing in addition to the legal uncertainties that may be influencing their decision, especially for pipelines. So again, I'm not an expert on the natural gas markets, but I understand there are very low natural gas prices, and there may be some questions about companies' willingness to produce if they can't recoup their costs in light of the very low gas prices. And then I think it's also worth noting that many states, including Virginia and North Carolina, who were the beneficiaries, for example, of that pipeline, both have recently adopted zero net energy goals by 2050. So natural gas, again, may not be a bridge fuel, or may already have been the bridge fuel that people thought it would be, bridging us from coal to lower carbon solutions. But maybe it's already done its work, right? We've already seen a lot of coal plants close. We've already seen a lot of natural gas go online. Maybe we're already on the other side of that bridge. And maybe these companies, recognizing the decarbonization goals that the states have established, maybe they're looking at making different investments that are more in line with those decarbonization goals. So I think there's no question that legal uncertainty certainly is a factor in their decision, and they did and do face a lot of uncertainty in their wetland crossing permits, which could further delay and add costs. But I think there may be additional factors that are playing a role in it beyond the legal issues. The other thing I note from the quote you made is that they said that large infrastructure projects are going to encounter difficulties. But I think one of the questions we also have is whether with the move toward decarbonization, there's also going to be a move to smaller projects, to smaller wind farms, smaller solar, more decentralized energy. And so I think that may be one of the other things that the energy companies are really going to need to look to. So I don't dispute that we're still going to need energy, no question. If anything, more electricity, for example. But I wonder whether we'll do it in a different way.
Yes, I mean, we certainly have studied decentralization and strongly believe that's one of the changes that we'll see in energy. Let me ask you, you talk about the legal uncertainties around natural gas pipelines. Do you feel that that same legal uncertainty would apply to a hydrogen pipeline or to an overhead electric transmission line? Or do you think those legal uncertainties are almost unique to just oil and gas pipelines?
I think the particular legal uncertainty we're looking at right now would apply to all of them. And I'm mindful that it would apply to electric transmission that would be necessary for renewables. So there, this could have impacts on all kinds of utility infrastructure, because the particular legal uncertainty that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline faced was around permits to cross streams and go through wetlands for various types of utilities, including pipelines, transmission lines, other kinds of, all kinds of pipelines. And the there was a basically a ruling in a district court that said that they would have to go through individual permitting processes for each of these crossings when before they simply had to meet a certain set of requirements. So I think that that will be an issue that that any kind of infrastructure will need to deal with.
One of the key thoughts we have is that infrastructure in general is going to be difficult to construct. Whether doesn't really matter what is the flavor. A hydrogen pipeline will be just as difficult to construct as an overhead power line. And I think for those reasons, as you said earlier, we firmly believe in decentralized systems, and think that that's one of the innovations of the future. You, I've at least given talks where I talk often about environmental justice, and I really emphasize its role in air quality. I think I would say I believe that people have a right to breathe clean air, and especially when we talk about transportation, I try to lead the parade around cleaner school buses. What do you see as this, where the subject of air quality intersects with your work and thinking?
I think air quality is essential especially as we look at climate change, there's a key overlap because you have just one emission stream. There's a emission from a truck, there's emissions from a school bus, or emissions from a factory or a refinery, and it's one process and it's one emission stream, and it emits a lot of pollutants that cause air quality problems. So that's going to be of concern to communities. And it also emits greenhouse gases. So a lot of my work focuses on climate policy, and I'm a firm believer that we should be integrating our strategies for reducing greenhouse gases with our strategies for reducing the pollutants that are causing air quality problems. One of the things that I really appreciated in the Select Committee, the House Select Committee's recommendations on climate change policy, which they issued last week, was the integration throughout the committee's report of concerns about air quality. And I happened to be looking most particularly at the provisions for trucks and other diesel sources like school buses. And in there, many programs that they are recommending that we support, they had a particular emphasis on funding transitions to cleaner school buses and cleaner trucks in communities experiencing high burdens of pollution and in environmental justice communities. So we think about what's going out into the community, but they also measure high levels of diesel for those kids on the buses.
Yeah, one of the things you may be surprised to realize, and we've been at the center of this for almost 14 or 15 years now, is a migration away from diesel school buses to propane powered school buses. And what we see there is not only are they quieter and not only are they much cleaner, and we see that with the students riding to school and the drivers taking the students to school, but in many other particulate matter is virtually zero. NOx emissions are reduced 96%, and they cost one quarter of the cost of an electric school bus. So that's a great transition because you live in California, obviously. The Advanced Clean Truck Rule just has come out, where they talk about 60% of medium and heavy duty trucks that are sold in the state needing to be zero emission by 2035. But what was your reaction to that environment, to that announcement?
I thought it was a terrific announcement because, again, I think it presents an integration of air pollution, environmental justice, and climate change concerns, because diesel is one of the most serious climate change causers. So diesel pollution has a concern in two different ways. One is that the soot that comes out of diesel is what we call black carbon, which apparently leads to faster global warming. The soot particles absorb heat, and if they often are airborne and are deposited even in the Arctic and other places, and they cause more melting. So there's a lot of reasons why we want to reduce diesel in particular, not only because of the direct greenhouse gas emissions, but because that black carbon causes particularly serious climate impacts. In addition, diesel is one of the most serious forms of air pollution that we have. The particulate matter in diesel is not just little bits of dirt, but often consists of a lot of toxic compounds. So we're very concerned about the air quality consequences in California. Diesel is one of the most significant risks, or has been one of the most significant cancer risks in the state. Also, diesel pollution is often concentrated in poor communities of color.
Today, 20,000 school buses exist in the United States operating on propane. School buses are a uniquely U.S. phenomena, but we now can demonstrate with absolute certainty that they are 97% cleaner than diesel buses in NOx emissions, nearly 100% reduction in particulate matter, significant reduction in noise. I mean, all of the things we want, yet they cost a quarter of the cost of an electric bus. And so if we had a migration to propane school buses instead of a migration to electric school buses, it would leave four times the amount of money either for faster adoption or to cure other ills, the ills of better education. I mean, one study we did is a movement to replace diesel buses with propane buses would save enough money to hire 23,000 new teachers into the school systems. Just one example of where the savings can now be applied to matters of real social justice. Do you have any feelings about why people quickly overlook real world near-term solutions for really solutions that don't exist, but a hope that they will exist in 2035? Can you try to help us see that disparity?
No, I can't put myself in the minds of the regulators or the agencies. I don't know what voice you have or those who support propane have in the agency hallways. So you have groups like the Western Petroleum Association who are very concerned about anything that would jeopardize oil and gas. And I don't know whether they are advocating for propane, right? So what are the organizations that are at the table? Who's at the table? What are they arguing for? I also don't know what I'm not questioning it, but I don't know what the full life cycle issues are in regard to propane. So in terms of how it's made, what are the environmental issues in terms of how it's produced and transported? I don't know what those are. I don't know whether those might have played a role in concerns about the desirability of propane as an alternative to diesel instead of the focus we see on zero emissions.
It's very interesting as we work, particularly in California, with a lot of the trucking companies, UPS, school bus systems, and even CARB leadership at the air quality management district level. There's this tremendous willingness and desire to substitute low carbon fuels, in our case specifically propane, for diesel, because it's not only there's an immediate benefit, it's also relatively economic to any other option. So as we hit a policy barrier, as we see a consistent belief that electrification will equal climate, a cleaner climate, and decarbonization. So I'm just curious. Let's change there for a second, because you have, I think, the luxuries of being a professor to the youth of tomorrow in your work at USF. For those topics, environmental justice, climate change, low carbon future, all of those things, how do you see the views of your students today differ from those views perhaps 10 years ago?
Well, I think there's a lot more knowledge about and more attention to the risk of climate change. So I think 10 years ago, students were much less aware of it, and now most of them are aware of it. In terms of environmental justice, I think there is less of an awareness of the disparities we see in environmental problems, although that may be changing with the Black Lives Movement matter and greater attention to the historic legacy of disadvantage that many communities experience. In terms of how they view a low carbon future, I would say they either know very little about what that will really mean or look like, or sometimes if they know a little more, there may be a bit of naivete that's still out there, sort of picturing that we can transition on a dime without recognizing some of the challenges, I think significant challenges that we're going to face. So I think in terms of a low carbon future, it varies a good bit.
Yeah, interesting. That's good. One of the basic tenets that I have and share often on this podcast is that fuels really aren't binary. They're not clean or dirty, but they range from very clean, I would argue solar and wind, very clean, hydro, pretty clean, to very dirty, coal, oil, pretty dirty. And their spectrum in the middle, low carbon fuels that I think clearly, as you alluded to earlier, can be an effective bridge. And with just a little bit of technology, very well may be equal to renewable electricity in many other ways. So I'm glad to see that today's students are at least thinking about low carbon and a cleaner climate. Let me ask it for you in your own view. Look forward 10 years, and certainly I think that's as we go into a political year and so much going on around social justice, environmental justice, but predict for us 10 years. You're a climate change expert, you're an educator, you're certainly an environmental justice expert. What happens in the next 10 years that makes you very happy?
Well, I would love to see concentrated decarbonization efforts occurring or prioritizing our most polluted areas. So we would reduce greenhouse gases where we would also be able to reduce their co-pollutants and provide the biggest public health benefits. Again, I think that's often going to be in communities of color, low-income communities of color. So that would mean your focus on things like school buses and trucks, I think very important to be reducing emissions there. Things like refineries or some of our other most polluting industries. Again, industries that are often disproportionately located in our most vulnerable communities. I'd also like the communities that have felt marginalized, right, in terms of pollution or jobs or economics, social statuses, I'd like those communities to feel like they've gotten the benefits of a clean energy transition, right? We do anticipate that we will be transitioning to clean energy, but who's gonna get things like clean transit or options for clean cars? Should we be focusing our efforts to at least assist that transition in communities that might otherwise be left out? Energy efficiency or solar to avoid potentially high costs that might occur? How do we get people to be using less energy, but make sure that those opportunities are done in the low-income communities that might otherwise not have the way. Things like weatherization programs, clean car subsidies in poorer communities, as well as clean economy jobs. How do we make sure that as we transition to a clean economy, those who've often felt challenged in having gainful employment get the skills and the opportunities? And then lastly, I'd say there are going to be some major transitions that we will see. We already talk about it as we see the collapse of coal. We see areas that have depended on coal struggling, right? Whether it's in Appalachia or in some of the Western states or Native American tribes. But I think that that concern and that problem will extend to many other areas as well. We see a lot of reliance on oil and gas in states like Louisiana, Texas. We're going to need new economic opportunities for the folks who've relied on those industries over the last few decades. So we're going to want to make sure that regionally across the country, we are thinking about how to extend the benefits of a clean energy economy and new opportunities for areas that may experience a difficult transition.
Yeah, wonderful. You are the first guest that's really talked about environmental justice, which I appreciate, but also conservation. And I clearly believe, I come at it not only for clean climate, but for also water and land use. But I think conservation is so important and is rarely discussed in the mix of tools that we'll need, you know, for the next two or three decades. So I really appreciate you introducing the concept. It's been really nice to have you. It's been a great conversation. And I not only thank you for sharing your expertise, but just for doing it in such a lovely way. And so I really appreciate that. One of the fun things we do for any guest on the Path to Zero is to plant a tree in a virtual forest, but a national forest. And we like to call it the Propane National Forest. And you're in California. We've had quite a few guests from California, and we have two spots that we do it. El Dorado National Forest, which is not very far from Lake Tahoe, a beautiful place, or the Sierra National Forest, which is very near to Yosemite. Would you have a favorite of those two places that you would like to have a tree planted?
Oh, I guess it'll be the Sierra Forest, because Yosemite is probably one of my favorite places in the world, me along with many others, but it is it's a unique and gorgeous environment. So why don't we go with the Sierra Forest?
Well, lovely. And I appreciate the pick, and I appreciate you being here with us today. This has been a great discussion. Thank you so much. And thank you to all of those listeners and taking time to be on this trip with us today on the Path to Zero.
Thank you.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.